From Nashville and Charlotte, this is the Shrink Tank Podcast. Each week, our panel of shrinks takes a look at the popular culture through the fascinating lens of psychology. I'm Dave Verhagen here in Nashville. I'm a psychologist, author, Comic-Con panelist, and lumberjack. And our trending topic today is the best movies of the new century so far. That's in our second segment. But first, let's meet our panel. Our Charlotte panel includes Emma Kate Wright. She's a doctoral intern in psychology and a contributor to ShrinkTank.com and a panelist for Heroes Con. Hello, Emma Kate.
Howdy.
And also, Jonathan Hederle is a licensed professional counselor, an expert on substance abuse treatment, and our own certified Asian who has written published book chapters on Game of Thrones, Star Wars, and Walking Dead. He served also as a panelist for Heroes Con. And each week, he rounds up two great stories of psychology in the news that we call Being Human.
So this first research looks and explores at how watching transgender characters on fictional TV shows has the power to influence attitudes towards transgender people and policy issues. And sort of interesting enough, even news coverage does not have the same effect. So a fictional storyline in the TV show Royal Pains proved to be more influential than news events, and its exposure to transgender issues in the news and even Caitlyn Jenner's transition had no effect on attitudes of the general viewing public. So, Emma Kate, what do you think about the positive role fictional TV shows can have on shaping people's attitudes towards controversial issues?
Oh, I think that's absolutely accurate. Entertainment has the power to influence and shape our ideology. And, you know, for myself personally, and I imagine a lot of other people, I have in recent times been avoiding the news just because I can't handle the constant bombardment of negative content. I want to stay informed, but at the same time, it's overwhelming. And so I've spent a lot of time watching entertainment to just kind of escape. And, you know, I think entertainment does provide that great opportunity to present difficult topics and start conversations about things that people wouldn't normally feel comfortable about and make it more relatable. So I like this.
I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you, but why do you think Royal Pains would have a bigger influence on people's view of transgender people than Caitlyn Jenner coming out? Like, that kind of is a stretch for me. I don't necessarily disagree, but I'm not sure why that would be.
I see your point on the Royal Pains piece. I have not actually watched that show. I don't even know. Is that a real show? I don't even know, to be honest. The one thing I can say about the Jenner-Kardashian piece there is a lot of people strongly dislike the Kardashians and felt like Caitlyn Jenner is essentially self-promoting and she's not accurately representing the trans community. And so I think for some people, her message kind of got lost in that process. But I hear your point on that.
Well, I think I have watched Royal Pains, and I think my theory would be because it essentially is a non-political show. It's a show really about entertainment, and for them to bring in sort of a hot topic issue where their overall kind of tone is not political. And I think that can really kind of maybe displace people in humanizing something versus it come across as they are heavily agenda-oriented. Like you look at Will and Grace, or you look at Ellen, you know, those shows, you immediately think of that there's a political angle or there's an agenda. And I'm not saying it's a bad or wrong agenda, but certain people may automatically shut off their willingness to kind of engage with the conversation and topic, whereas Royal Pains, it's really an apolitical show. And then for them to bring a storyline that humanizes a controversial topic, I think that might be why it has the impact it did.
I can buy it.
All right. Now, moving on. The recent events in Charlottesville, Virginia have brought attention to the rise of white supremacists, extremism, and even toxic masculinity. So the concept of toxic masculinity is used in the social science to describe traditional norms of behavior among contemporary men that are associated with detrimental social and psychological effects. And then we look at new research that suggests tendencies towards aggression and what fuels the rise of white supremacy and white supremacists and extremism. They look at the dark triad, which is a personality traits of Machiavellianism, if I said that right, psychopathy and narcissism. They find that they're more prominent among supremacists who identify with the political movement known as the alt-right. And Machiavellianism, again, if I'm saying that correctly, because there's a lot of letters in that word, it's a tendency to manipulate other people for one's own gain. But ultimately, some of this research suggests that racial extremism may be more about belonging than just simply some of these more aggressive and extreme attitudes. So, Dave, all of the recent events in Charlottesville, all of this conversation and attention towards white supremacy, extremism, toxic masculinity, what do you make of all of this?
Well, as the toxically masculine member of the panel, I will say
that's you.
I have had the opportunity to talk to, over the years, a few guys who have been white supremacists, either in therapy or just in interviews or things like that. And almost without exception, these guys are all wounded dudes. You know, they are all guys that were picked on in middle school, excluded. And I know that sounds stereotypical, but that's been my experience of, and not that I have interviewed dozens and dozens, but enough that that's the theme. So, you know, when I look at these guys, I see guys that this is a giant overcompensation for how they felt like they were excluded, how they feel like they were, minimized and marginalized and picked on. And so you would think that somebody who'd been treated like crap when they were younger would not turn around and treat somebody else like crap and marginalize and dump on them. But that's what tends to happen. You know, that, and I think that's what we're seeing, is that you've got a lot of guys that this has been their experience. Now, here's the other part too, and this is not quite different, but it's another angle on this. I think some of this reflects how emotionally soft young men are often today. And, you know, you've got these guys who are middle-class white guys who are out there feeling like they are losing everything, that they're being victimized, that they're being their country's being taken away from them, that they're, you know, and it's just super weird that they feel like they're these, you know, like they're being victimized. And so I think part of that big picture is that we have a generation of young guys that have not faced a lot of legit hardship, and that when they are faced with difficulty in life, they don't have the emotional strength or stamina or resiliency to really do anything other than have this weird reaction to it. So long answer, but that's kind of what I'm thinking is going on.
Well, and it's interesting when you think about minority groups and women, they are more accustomed, I would argue, to looking at the world and feeling maybe victimized or feeling like there are certain kind of parts of life that they really have an uphill battle. And I think that just by that kind of default setting, they adapt resiliency and grit and recognize the unfairness of life in some social institutions, whereas I feel like white middle-class guys are starting to experience that on their own, and they don't know how to adapt. They do not know how to receive it in a way that, like, if you tell a minority group that, you know, people are going to perceive you or have bias or stereotypes about you, they're just like, of course they are. You know, they already have that built into their outlook on life.
Right, right. And I think the article mentioned a good thing about how these individuals, and maybe it's a blanket statement, but they favor the sort of social hierarchy where, you know, the white Caucasian male is at the top. And so, and if I can't remember if it was this article or a different article I was reading about kind of that warrior mentality where, you know, in order to kind of stay on top and keep control of what you've conquered, you know, you're going to do whatever you can to maintain that control, so to speak. And so then that's where you see that really extreme aggression, high masculinity piece that comes out. And again, it is toxic.
Well, there's a lot of good things about masculinity. And, you know, it's debated in psychology circles about toxic masculinity. But, you know, what gets overlooked is that masculinity in many ways, it's a very, there's a lot of really good things about it. But what when it gets expressed like this, in this sort of, to use the term toxic way, it's really ugly. But it's just bizarre that we've gotten to a place where that white men feel like they're the most persecuted minority group, and yet it's they've got the easiest gig not only in the country but on earth. You know, a white man in the United States has the easiest gig anywhere, and yet there's the sense that they feel like they're oppressed, and that the only people that you can discriminate against now are white men. It's really a product of not ever having experienced a lot of hardship or opposition or difficulty. And so now, you know, there's the country's changing, there's pushback, there's different social movements, and they don't know what to do with it. And so some of these guys end up becoming kind of, you know, taking on this more toxic approach. I will also say something that's super duper weird and scary to me, and that is a recent poll said that 10% of the U.S. population think it's okay to hold white supremacist and neo-Nazi views. Now, that's got to be the craziest thing I've heard in a year. I mean, that's beyond crazy.
Where was the poll from, by chance? Do you remember?
I don't have it handy, but it's been widely circulated. But 1 in 10 Americans in this poll came out within the last week or week and a half, believe it's okay if someone holds views that are white supremacist or neo-Nazi supporting views. That's crazy.
Yeah, that definitely feels like we're going backwards in our society.
I mean, 10%. It's in one sense it's a small minority, but it's one out of every 10 people.
That's good and math there, Dave.
Yeah, I'm pretty good at the math thing. Yeah. So that's just beyond strange to me.
Well, yeah, and I would say, you know, overall, and this would be the one thing I would point to, maybe social media and the internet, is there's definitely, I feel like, been a rise of devaluing of others, whether it be trolling people online or just even the rise of, you know, neo-Nazi extremist or racist views. That really is about the devaluing and dehumanizing of others.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely more part of our culture than it was a decade ago, 20 years ago, for sure.
But I do think that, you know, some of the research that they're trying to begin doing is important for us to really focus on, where it's more preventative. How do we stop people? Because I think one of the articles discussed, you know, that if we can change the motivation to express prejudice, that may prevent people from acting aggressively. And so that this research, it's important that we're talking about it, even though I know I feel uncomfortable with it and it's a hard thing for a lot of people, but it's good that we're really trying, like, we got to do something. So,
yeah, absolutely. All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about our trending topic. It's the best movies of the new century so far. This is the Shrink Tank Podcast.
Good psychology can change your life. At PsychBytes, we feature articles and videos with practical psychology that you can use every day. PsychBytes is a new psychology website with free articles and videos from dozens of the best psychology experts. Check it out on psychbytes.com.
Welcome back to the Shrink Tank Podcast. I'm Dave Verhagen in Nashville, along with Jonathan Hederle and Emma Kate Wright in Charlotte. And our trending topic today is the best movies of the new century so far. And for whatever reason, I don't know why 2017 seems like the point, but there have been a number of websites and outlets that have popped up these polls. And I guess we're just getting a running start on the new century. But we've done the same thing. Jonathan and I have both taken some time to take inventory of movies over the last 17 years and what we think the best movies of the new century are so far. So before we get into that, Emma Kate, have you given any thought to this in terms of movies that have come out from 2000 on that really jump out for you as best movies?
Yeah, one of the movies, you know, and I was thinking about this, that really hit home for me at least was Up. So this was a Disney Pixar film that came out in 2009. And the story in this was just a sweet story about this cranky old man, Carl. He's recently a widower. And then there's this, you know, Boy Scout, Russell, who comes along and somehow is a stowaway on his floating house. And they have this great adventure. But this film, there were a lot of firsts, at least in terms of just awards and nominations. But this was one of the first films, I think, that Disney released that talked about divorce. And I thought that was a really powerful thing that Disney and Pixar started to include those sorts of conversations, given that, you know, divorce has been on the rise and a lot of kids can relate to that. And then, you know, just the fact that the music in this film was so unbelievable. Michael Giacchino is one of my favorite composers, and it won a Grammy, a Golden Globe, an Academy Award. And then there are obviously some other movies out there. Russell Crowe is one of my favorite actors. I'm obsessed with The Gladiator. I also loved A Beautiful Mind. And then in past podcasts, we've talked about Christopher Nolan and his work and The Dark Knight. So, yeah, there have been a lot of really good movies that have come out in the 2000s.
Do you think, by and large, the state of movie making is better, worse, about the same as it was in previous let's say generations, like if we go back to the 90s or 80s or 70s, do you think the state of movie making since the turn of the century has been better, or has it declined, or is it kind of a mixed bag?
Truthfully, the only movies I cared about when I was younger, Beauty and the Beast. I mean, I was young in the 90s. And
I was young. I was foolish.
I don't know. No, but I think there are a lot of pros that can come out from, you know, when we're thinking about 2000 mark on, just in terms of, you know, I look back at things like Jaws and I'm like, oh, that's not even scary. And the effects in that are terrible. And so now with all the computer animation, we're getting these really awesome visuals. But then at the same time, though, I think with some of the superheroes and this movement for multiple sequels, we're losing a little bit of that novelty and originality, which we're starting to see more in Netflix and TV shows. So I think there's some pros and cons to kind of the shift that we've seen.
And Jonathan, what do you think about the state of movie making since the turn of the century?
Well, when I started compiling my list, I actually surprised myself by how much rich, a huge catalog of, I think, worthy material had to be considered for making the best of so far this century. I think there's a lot of great films. I also think there's actually a lot of great filmmakers that are consistently making quality film. You think of Wes Anderson, you think of Alfonso Cuarón, you think of obviously Christopher Nolan, Paul Thomas Anderson, even the Coen brothers, even some people that go back into the 90s, they're still churning out great, great films. So I feel like even though we've talked about how the changing landscape of Hollywood and blockbusters and superheroes, the movies that at the end of the year, I'm compiling as the best of the year, there's still some really worthy films that are being made.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would argue that I think the state of movie making, by and large, is better. We still have dumb movies. We still have bad movies, but we've always had that. And if you look at the really good movies, not just technically, but in terms of the innovative storytelling, the depth of character development, some of that stuff, really, I think, some outstanding stuff happening. So, Jonathan, I tell you what, you and I both picked the top 17. Why don't we take our top three and just talk about it? And if people want to look at our lists for the remaining 17, they can go to shrinktank.com. But talk through your top three of the 2000s and beyond.
Sure. So my number three was 2014's Boyhood by Richard Linklater. And that movie is just such a unique film-going experience. And you and I, we actually saw it in the theater with our wives, so it wasn't just the movie boyfriends out on their own. Actually, I think I went with you and Ellen. Julie did not come with us. But it's so, on one level, very simple, and not a lot happens, but there's just the subtlety, the nuances, and what it kind of evokes through showing 12 years of real people's lives kind of pass over 3 hours. It really just hit me. And just obviously working with teenage and young guys, just how that kind of emotionally resonated with me as well. So that was number three. Number two was Children of Men. That's 2006. That's Alfonso Cuarón. And that movie is just this really cool genre-bending kind of movie that, you know, tackles a dystopian sort of, you know, kind of period and tackles infertility, immigration. And it's got these long, crazy, uninterrupted shots. And some are just kind of they're not so ambitious, just like a car chase or like an escape. But others with some of the battle scenes are really complex. And that movie really is tense. And it's only grown on me. And then my number one movie is The Social Network, which is David Fincher's 2010 kind of exploration on the origins of Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg. And for me, that movie just is firing on all these different cylinders on such a high level: the direction, the screenwriting, the score, the editing, just, you know, multiple timelines and things along those lines. I thought that all of those things just came together beautifully. So those would be my top three movies: Boyhood, Children of Men, and The Social Network.
All three of those are on my short list. Your two and three are my five and six, and I'll just comment on those two real quick. Children of Men, I saw that with a group of about six guys, and when we walked out, there's maybe me and one other person that thought it was great, and the other people didn't even like it. And so I thought, well, maybe I've missed something here. I mean, I thought it was a great movie. I said so. We were standing in the lobby talking about it, and I thought that was just fantastic. And the consensus of the group was meh. And then I saw Alfonso Cuarón on a panel at Comic-Con talking about the making of the film and how they made the scene, the long take where they're escaping in the car and one of the people gets shot and it's all a continuous take. So I said, I need to watch this movie again. And I loved it. It held up not only as well as I remember it, but even better. So for me, it's definitely on a short list. And Boyhood is one of my all-time favorite movies. I put it as number six on my list, but not because I don't think it's a great movie. I mean, it's six of all time or of the turn of the century for me, but it's one of my favorite movies ever. And I was just curious, Emma Kate, did you get to see Boyhood, and what was your experience of it?
No, unfortunately, I have not seen Boyhood. I haven't seen like any of the movies you guys have talked about. So I have some watching to do.
You got some catching up. Well, yeah. I'll tell you, the thing about Boyhood is that nothing happens in the movie, for real. I mean, like it's scene after scene of just really mundane life. And there's only one like kind of dramatic scene in the whole thing. And yet the point of the movie is you're watching this kid grow up from being a little kid to being a college freshman. And it's saying an ordinary life is a work of art. An ordinary life is a significant and important thing. And I don't think I've ever seen a movie that did that. So it's absolutely a ringer. It's one of the best. Your number one was my number three, The Social Network. Great movie. And then my top two, number two for me was Lord of the Rings. And I had to pick one of the three in the trilogy, The Return of the King. But to be honest, I really think of those as one movie. I think of the trilogy as a package. And if I think about it that way, that's my favorite movie of all time. I didn't put it as the best movie, but I put it as second best, but definitely my favorite movie of all time. Loved it. And my favorite movie of all time was a very polarizing movie that some people hate, But I love, and I don't just think it's a great movie. I actually love the movie. I think it just got under my skin in a way I didn't expect. And it's There Will Be Blood, Paul Thomas Anderson's epic. It's just a classic movie. It works on every level. The acting, I think, we're in that movie. Daniel Day-Lewis, I think, gives the best performance in film history. I really do. I think the photography, the cinematography is fantastic. The score is amazing. The characters, the story writing, every bit of it is just a remarkable movie. I rarely see movies more than once. I've seen this movie three times. It's as good every single time I watch it. So, Jonathan, what's your take on that particular movie?
Well, that was my number four movie, There Will Be Blood. And I remember seeing it, and it actually was so tense, and it was so engulfing. It took me actually several days to wrap my head around how I ultimately felt about it, because I remember going, I just experienced something, and I need some space to kind of ultimately say, like, was it great? Was it a masterpiece? Was it just really good or manipulative? Because it really was quite the film-going experience. And I actually, like Children of Men, I never got to see on the big screen. Boyhood, I did. There Will Be Blood, I did. And to me, it's no surprise, and I saw Social Network as well on the big screen. To me, it's no surprise some of these movies, they have such a profound impact, because I go into a theater and I am completely engulfed by the experience. It's not on even like a big TV in my home. I just have to let go and immerse myself in the experience. So I'm not surprised that these movies, I had such a strong response and reaction to.
Yeah, and these movies are movies I've obviously heard of. I just have not. I don't go to the movies too often, but I think it's great that it speaks volumes that you guys actually have similar lists, or at least some of the movies are kind of near each other. So I'm definitely looking forward to checking some of those guys out.
So, Jonathan, tell me a movie that's on your list of 17 that is surprising. Tell me a movie that might not show up on somebody else's best of the new century so far list.
Well, my bottom two, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, I think that just sort of gets forgotten. It was right at the turn of the century, 2000. I'm a pretty big proponent of foreign film, and I think that's one of Ang Lee's more poetic and lyrical films. And then the other one is I really like Wes Anderson stuff. He's always a mixed bag, because I can always pick apart some things about his movies I don't like or I don't think completely work. But when he decided to do stop motion animation and did The Fantastic Mr. Fox, I really love that movie. I think that movie is a great mix of even the talent like George Clooney and Meryl Streep, and they're made for animation, and Wes Anderson's aesthetics is made for animation. So I kept finding a reason to not have it on my list, and I could never justify adding another movie in its place.
There are two movies that we both have on our list that I don't think are going to show up on a lot of other lists, at least at this stage. One of them surprises me, the other one I was expecting. The one I was expecting was The Raid 2, because you turned me onto that movie and I loved it, and I showed it to my oldest daughter and she watched it. It's a long movie. It's like almost not 3 hours, but over 2.5 hours. She watched it twice back to back. So she spent like 6 hours watching this movie the same day. It's the godfather of action movies. It's fantastic. But the movie that was surprising that was on both of our lists was Grizzly Man. That was a nutty documentary. So talk a little bit about that one.
Well, Werner Herzog, I think he is a nutty man, a nutty director. And that movie is—it just feels like it should be a parody. It shouldn't be a real story and a real documentary, but it is. And it sounds ludicrous, but as you watch it, as you listen to what's transpiring in the film, it's just so crazy. And I don't know how to describe it to other people. But basically, like, I've seen it once. I never need to see it again. But it's like, it's unlike any other documentary I've ever watched.
Yeah, for me too. It felt like watching a Christopher Guest mockumentary. It just was felt made up, but it was true. And
like
it was,
David Lynch, Christopher Guest mockumentary.
Right. It just made your head spin. And then the thing that the reason it's on my list is, number one, it was something I'd never seen before, which is always a good criteria for me. And number two, I was all over the place emotionally with it. Like I was like angry at this guy. I was sad for him. I was confused. It was funny. It was tragic. It was everything. And it just a completely wild emotional experience watching a movie. Well, if you guys want to check out our full list, you can go to shrinktank.com. You'll see some movies on there that you'll expect to see probably, and a few that you won't expect to see. But both articles are up on shrinktank.com. All right, we're going to take our last break. When we come back, we'll have a quick little discussion. This is the Shrink Tank Podcast.
Hero House Publishing is pleased to announce Heroic Inspirations by Michael Kreitzer. Over the ages, superheroes in various forms have been speaking to humanity in togas, robes, and now tights and capes. They speak to us about the human condition. They help us work through our fears and failures. Heroic Inspirations draws out rich lessons superheroes provide for our daily lives. How does Superman teach us to deal with difficult people? What do the X-Men tell us about balancing individual and communal identities? Superheroes speak to these and many other life questions. Michael Kreitzer has been researching and teaching on superheroes for over 10 years, and now his book, Heroic Inspirations, is available to you at herohousepublishing.com or amazon.com. Order your copy today.
Welcome back to the Shrink Tank Podcast. I'm Dave Verhagen with Jonathan Hederle and Emma Kate Wright, and we wrap this all up with a quick little discussion about late-night hosts who are really stepping up in this new era. And I will tell you that there are five in particular that I want to highlight. But before I ask that, Jonathan or Emma Kate first, do you watch late night television? And if so, who do you favor?
I occasionally do. But again, I've mentioned this before where I don't watch a ton of TV or movies. And so when I take time to do that, it's generally I'm looking for fluff. I'm looking for things that are escapism. I will occasionally see clips from Jimmy Kimmel Live just because I feel like he takes more of a lighthearted comedy approach. I know James Corden does some good stuff too. So I'd say probably between those two if I'm going to watch anything.
All right. And how about you, Jonathan?
Well, you know, the internet is built for me to just watch little clips now versus stay up late and watch the whole episode. I tend to favor John Oliver, Stephen Colbert. I'll catch Jimmy Kimmel or Jimmy Fallon. Jimmy Kimmel, I really like his monologues much more than his interviews. And then Jimmy Fallon has a lot of fun sort of little setup games. But for my contempt at what's going on in the world, I definitely lean towards John Oliver or Stephen Colbert.
Yeah, so it feels like there are two things going on in late night television. One is the kind of the escapist stuff that Jimmy Fallon and James Corden, yeah, and a little bit Jimmy Kimmel, he's somewhere in between, offer. And so if you're just sort of like, I just want to not think and I don't want to, you know, be reminded of how crappy things are going, you'd watch them. But then if you're really wanting some biting commentary, there are five people that are really bringing their A game. And I'll put them in order. I think Stephen Colbert, Seth Meyers, John Oliver, Samantha Bee, and Trevor Noah. All those are doing fantastic job. Stephen Colbert, I think, is the man of the hour. I think he's the guy that is the voice of the kind of opposition party at this point. And he's doing fantastic work. Seth Meyers is stepped up in a way that I am totally surprised by. He's always been pretty good, but he's really got some biting commentary, really good stuff. And John Oliver, very similar. Those two are kind of neck and neck for me. Samantha Bee's doing a great job. Trevor Noah is rising to the occasion. He had a little slower start, but those five in particular. So I'm someone who does stay up and watch the shows, and I'm just really impressed with how what they're bringing to late night. So I just encourage people to watch that. All right. That's going to do it for this edition of the Shrink Tank podcast. We hope you'll check out shrinktank.com for articles, videos, and polls about all kinds of things in popular culture. And make sure you check out the best movies of the new century so far, articles from both me and Jonathan Hederle. They're both up on shrinktank.com. Please follow us on Twitter at shrink_tank and like us on Facebook by searching for the Shrink Tank podcast. Our producer and theme music composer is Sean Beck. In the Queen City, it's Emma Kate Wright and Jonathan Hederle. And from Music City, I'm Dave Verhagen. Thanks for listening. Please tell all your friends about us and make it a good week.